gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Molman. This is the My View Matters Radio Network. So, interesting week in news, and one of the things that came out on the Liberty side of things was the decision, at least a verbal decision, from the Obama administration that they are not going to pursue legal recourse against the states that have legalized marijuana, and it'll be very interesting to see what comes of it. Here in a few minutes, we're going to have sometimes caller, friend of the show, a friend of mine, Daniel Williams, who is a drug policy analyst and someone who I go to, kind of my go-to guy when it comes to issues of drug use and or policy in general. And so, actually, I think it's him right here in the queue, so without any further ado, let's just go ahead and bring him on and start talking about this. Daniel, are you with us?
I sure am, Ken. How you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing real well. Thank you, sir. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I appreciate you having me on your show tonight. I listen to it whenever I can, and I know a lot of people listen to it, so that's a good thing.
No, very, very good. And, you know, when I heard the news that, and honestly, it surprised me. I fully expected when they said, you'll hear our ruling soon, I figured that was going to be some big lawsuit when it was filed or something to that effect. But I was very surprised that they decided, you know what, we're just not going to mess with it, or at least that's what they say. So I figured you were the guy to get on here to talk about this because you follow this more closely than I do. And those that listen to the show regularly know that I don't know everything, but I do know people who do know lots of things. And so I bring them onto the show to enlighten our listenership on what's going on. So I guess where to start with this is, what's your general feeling on this? I mean, were you surprised by it? Was it something you expected? Where were you at on this issue?
Well, what's happened, as most of your readers will, or most of your listeners will know, is that Washington State and Colorado have legalized the use of marijuana for adults 21 and over. So that's the national news that has sparked the ongoing conversation. What you have, what we can do, there are three possible scenarios that can happen with what's happened in Washington and Colorado. But we need to look through the lens of the 2009 Holder memo and the old adage of actions speak louder than words. We have now, like I said, those two states. So there are three possible scenarios. The best case scenario would be that President Obama would remove marijuana from the Controlled Substance Act and allow the states to make their own decisions. That's the best possible scenario. The worst case is that the government will go after Washington and Colorado via lawsuits and drug raids, and that will stifle any states following up on Washington and Colorado. What will probably happen, and what we're starting to see, at least in the words aspect of it, is pretty much a benign neglect from the government. President Obama mentioned in his interview with Barbara Walters that, and this is a direct quote when asked about marijuana, he said that they have bigger fish to fry. Now, that's been interpreted in a number of different ways, but the best case scenario of that is that he lets Washington and Colorado continue with their programs and to show that the sky doesn't fall if marijuana is legalized. And then if that's the case, once it doesn't look like there's going to be any problems, more states will follow. But again, you have to look at this through the prism and the actions speak louder than words. In 2009, Eric Holder's famous marijuana memo said that they were not going to interfere with the states that had medical marijuana laws on their books. But they reserved the right to assist the states should they find people inside their states in violation of the medical marijuana laws, which were written fairly vaguely. So since then, there have been a stepped-up number of raids in California. So the benign neglect aspect of the most recent statement by President Obama again, has been parsed out many different ways, but we're hopeful that the best case scenario, or the probability that benign neglect will allow this to move through without any blowback from the federal government.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the number of drug raids under Obama was stepped up from the number that were executed under Bush. Is that correct?
That's correct. From a purely factual standpoint, President Obama has been a more rabid drug warrior than President Bush and all presidents preceding Bush. So that's not a good sign. That's the action as opposed to the words.
Right. So I guess, we're going to have to wait and see what comes of this, but at least, the words sound good, or at least partially. Has there been any other action? I mean, I haven't seen any other recourse or anything really going on as far as a negative coming of the legalization. I mean, have you heard anything coming down the pipeline at all other than this statement?
Well, no, but generally the population is out in front of the government on most issues, and this is not an exception. There seems to be a steady polling where a majority of Americans, and it's not much, maybe 52 to 56, depending upon the poll, but it's a majority nonetheless, they believe two things. Marijuana should be legalized, and second of all, they believe that the states that go ahead and legalize it themselves should be left alone by the federal government. That's the sentiment in the national polling of how things are panning out. The interesting thing is that, or one of the interesting things, are the principal players in the drug policy field. You have three main players. You've got the Drug Policy Alliance, you've got the Marijuana Policy Project, and you have NORML. And the Drug Policy Alliance, that is funded primarily by George Soros, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with George Soros. And it's run by Ethan Nadelman. Excuse me. Now, George Soros will quit funding the Drug Policy Alliance if Ethan Nadelman goes too strongly against Obama, because George Soros himself has bigger fish to fry. So the Drug Policy Alliance has become, at least in the grassroots area of drug policy reform, they've become kind of neutered. They're not looked to as being any great innovators. They're more of game players. The Marijuana Policy Project, that's funded by the progressive insurance heir, Peter Lewis. And those guys have been around a while, but they suffered a setback in 2010 with a sex scandal with the founder of the company, Rob Campia. NORML, they've been around the longest, and they were started by Keith Straub and is now run by Alan St. Pierre. And they're considered the least effective. But those are the three groups out there that are fighting for some type of decriminalization and legalization of marijuana. The grassroots folks that I'm most in contact with look to these three groups as being, okay, you guys have had your moment in the sun, thanks for what you've done, but we need new leadership. So there's a groundswell of support growing in the grassroots movement to bring in new blood, I guess, for lack of a better term. And some of the best new blood out there is a group called the Marijuana Majority. And that was founded by a fellow by the name of Tom Angel. And then you've got LEAP, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, which is the only group out there, the only drug policy group, that advocates the complete repeal of drug prohibition. And LEAP is a bunch of former police officers, many of them that worked in narcotics, that have decided that drug prohibition is wrong, and they are working to repeal all of drug prohibition, not just marijuana. But I don't want to get too far off the subject at hand. Listening to what Obama told Barbara Walters has created some hope, and I don't know if it's a false hope or not, but we're hoping that, as I mentioned, the probability aspect is that there's a benign neglect and they allow the states to move forward and keep an eye on them, and when the sky doesn't fall, then you'll see cluster of states happen. You'll see the states around Colorado will legalize. The states around Washington will legalize. You'll see a pocket of states in the Northeast. something in the Midwest, but the southern portions of the United States will probably be the last to come on board with legalization.
Right. Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me. Living in Kentucky, I know one of the big pushes here, and this could have ramifications here, is the industrial hemp movement, which, they are related plants, but they're not the same plant. And so the people who have been pushing for it here, we actually have some elected officials that have been in favor of it. And I'm curious to see if our state officials will have the guts to go ahead and legalize it for growth here. And if the federal government isn't going to step in, then, we just kind of operate de facto. But be very interesting to see if that occurs. You mentioned law enforcement. I just wanted to bring up an anecdote on that. A good friend of mine who is a former judge said that at any one time in his court, up to 75% of the cases that he was dealing with were simple possession charges. And, you can sit there and you can think about all the resources that our court system uses on a day-to-day basis, and everything from, the police action itself to the arrest to the incarceration to the lawyers to the clerks to the judges themselves, all these people spending time on all of these enforcement actions for simple possession. It comes out to a large, large amount of money, for each and every one. And then you multiply that out by how many people actually get busted on a simple possession charge. It's a pretty significant amount of money. And I don't know that anybody has ever sat down and really tried to figure out exactly how much it costs. But like I said, this friend of mine who's a former judge said, it's absolutely ridiculous. And there are better things for the courts to be doing than dealing with simple possession.
Well, not only is it a financial drain on resources, but it also inhibits the criminal justice process for cases that have greater significance. You have a tremendous backlog in the court system, and everybody decries that, and they want to get more judges and more court set up. But the reality is, like you mentioned, your friend said 75% of the cases were involved were simple possession. So what that does, it clogs the court system and costs a tremendous amount of money, but it also limits the due process procedures for other crimes where somebody gets arrested for a violent felony. His case is either prolonged or a plea is copped just to lighten the load on the criminal justice system. So if they were to eliminate marijuana as a criminal offense, you would see a tremendous pressure release on the criminal justice system. Not only that, 800,000 young people, mostly are young people every year, over 800,000, are arrested for the simple possession of marijuana. And yes, it's true when they say, well, we don't throw them all in jail, but that's not the point. The point is they put them inside the criminal justice system, and once you're in the criminal justice system, you carry that stigma with you throughout the rest of your life or for a large portion of it. So it eliminates a lot of young people from the job market, from the college loan market. So that's one of the hidden costs out there of arresting 800,000 people a year for the simple possession of marijuana.
In economic terms, that's the opportunity cost, if you will, where you're losing people who otherwise would have been beneficial members of society, people who otherwise would have, gone on to do regular jobs, regular work, been gainfully employed and productive people, basically making it so that they cannot function in society. It's unfortunate.
One of the cruel ironies is that President Obama, in his books, spoke very openly about enjoying smoking marijuana and how he smoked it all the time. And the fact is, had Barack Obama been arrested for possession of marijuana during his wasted years, so to speak, he would not be president of the United States today. There's just absolutely no question about it. Had he been thrown into the criminal justice system, he would not be where he is now. That says two things. It points to the hypocrisy of President Obama, it also points to the lie that people who smoke pot never amount to anything. So
sure. He wasn't the first president either. I mean, I believe Bill Clinton admitted to using it, though he claimed he never inhaled.
Right.
And President Bush, I believe, never really got very specific upon his particular use or what he did, but I think it's generally accepted that he also engaged in partaking in some sort of illegal drug use.
Yeah, he smoked pot, but he also when you dig down deep and get to some of the players that were around him when he was in the baseball business, he snorted his fair share of cocaine as well. So yeah, he completely dodged the issue as president. But well, now we have a president who openly endorsed the idea of getting high when he was young. So you have the most concrete evidence of a successful person. I mean, who can deny that being president of the United States is one of the most successful occupations in the world? And yet,
sure,
our current president bragged about the fact that he even had a gang. He called it the Choom Gang, a Choom. The Choom Gang is what he belonged to back in his Hawaii days, and they were smoking probably some of the best pot out there. So the hypocrisy is just galling. That's what's driving a lot of young people in the drug policy movement away from Obama. You'd be surprised, and maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but a lot of young people in this election voted for Gary Johnson specifically because of his drug policy positions. In fact, in Colorado, the legalization of marijuana got 1.7 million votes, and Obama got 1.5 million. So more people voted for the legalization of pot in Colorado and voted for President Obama. So these things are coming into like a cumulative effect, a snowball effect. And what you have now is we're set up with a confrontation with the federal government. In Colorado, Colorado is a tougher case for the federal government because Colorado enshrined it in their constitution. So it is an amendment to their constitution. It's not an initiative. It's not a proposition. It's enshrined in their constitution. So as far as the legal aspect is concerned, the federal government will have a much tougher time dealing with the state of Colorado because in Colorado it takes 2/3 of the popular vote to repeal a constitutional amendment, and they don't foresee that happening at all in Colorado. So the stage has been set for a federal government against the federal constitution against a state constitution. That's why Colorado is infinitely more important than Washington.
And that is an interesting point. I never did dig into the details of either of those states' laws. Now, did they create anything specific or special about them, or is it just straight-up decriminalization and everything's fine? What was the specifics on the regulation? I mean, is there a special tax, as has been proposed, how did that break out?
Well, what happened in Colorado? Let's just speak of Colorado because that's the battleground state. They enshrined it in their constitution for it's legal, not decriminalized per se, but it is legal for adults 21 and over to possess up to 1 ounce of marijuana and the growing of 6 plants. That is the law. Now, what Colorado is going to do? They're going to distribute this at least initially through state stores, just like some states do alcohol through the state store system. So the tax structure as has been proposed is basically a 25% tax on the grower, a 25% tax on the distributor, and a 25% tax on the retailer. That's roughly how they're going to look at it from a tax gathering perspective.
Okay.
And even at that, when you have those, I mean, those are erroneous. I mean, they're just heinous tax levels. I mean, tobacco is not taxed that high. Gas isn't taxed that high. But even with that type of a tax structure, the cost for an ounce of marijuana could be as an ounce of good hydroponic, high-quality marijuana would be around $125 an ounce. That same ounce of high-quality marijuana now will go from anywhere from $350 to $600, depending upon where you are. So you'll have even with those types of tax structures, the cost to grow marijuana is relatively inexpensive by comparison to the cost of the prohibition tax. Once you amortize all of your costs in a mid-range grow operation, once you amortize all your costs, you can grow a pound of high quality pot for about $400. Now that's that same pound of pot now in the illegal market sells anywhere from $4,000 to $6,000. So you're going to see a tremendous reduction in the overall cost structure. And again, even with terrible tax rates of 25%, 25%, 25%, you're still going to be able to buy an ounce of high-quality marijuana for $125 to $150. And that would be a price that would take almost everybody out of the grow-your-own market. I mean, beer is cheap, so you don't have a lot of people making their own beer. Wine is reasonably priced, so you don't have a lot of people making their own wine. When the cost is not prohibitive, people will buy as opposed to grow. The same scenario that you see in Amsterdam. One point I want to make on the cost structure as well. Most people now, when they buy marijuana, they'll buy in hoard. They'll buy enough that it'll take them a month or two to smoke because they'll buy a larger quantity, not knowing when they can buy it again. In Amsterdam, when you can buy it in many places every day, access is very open. Most people only buy what they'll smoke in a 2 or 3 day time period. So the transactional quantity issue will be much less. People are not going to be buying ounces of pot. They're going to be buying it in the one eighth of an ounce, small quantities because it's accessible so easily. They're not going to hoard their pot.
And that makes sense. I mean, unless there's some sort of huge price differential, people tend not to buy in bulk. And in today's setup, there's a cost or a risk, I guess, involved in any transaction you make. So it makes sense to buy a larger amount in one shot rather than if it's, free and clear and whatever. I don't go to the store and buy, 6 gallons of beer. I buy a six-pack.
Exactly. That's the exact mentality that will happen in the marijuana business. Exactly
right.
That mentality.
Yeah. I mean, if it was illegal to buy beer and you wanted beer, you'd be buying it by the truckload and, hauling it back as fast as you could and hiding it somewhere, which I believe was kind of what happened in the Prohibition era. But I guess the point is that, and I did the math on this, so 25% tax, and I assume this is 25% each step of the way, so it compounds. Looks like it's going to be basically a 95% on top of the grower's cost to the end user. And that's not accounting for, any markup or anything like that. So you're looking at about 200 to 200 and something percent of the cost to grow is probably what will be the final cost to the final person purchasing it. And, I don't know a whole lot about the pricing, but you had mentioned, I think, $400 a pound. It seems like $800 a pound is cheap, I guess. I don't know.
Well, yeah, well, let's say the guy that grows it for $400 a pound sells it for $800 a pound, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The guy that buys it, the middleman that buys it for $800 a pound, let's say he sells it for $1,200 a pound. So the guy buying it at retail, he's buying a pound of pot at $1,200 a pound, which there's 16 ounces in a pound, so he's paying less than $100. The retailer is paying less than $100 for his ounce. So he adds, his 25%, which would be, $25 to it. So he's got $125 cost for his product, and he could sell it for $150 and still make as good a margin as Microsoft. And the more states that legalize pot, you'll see the tax structures probably settle down into a reasonable amount, because if two contiguous states have a vastly different tax structure, the state with the highest tax structure is going to lose revenue to the state with the lower. So that 25% tax probably will be the highest tax structure we see. And it may not go down quickly, but I don't think it's going to go up.
Okay. Well, when we get, we're at the bottom of the hour here, so we're going to take a break. But when we get back, I want to talk to you about a few more things. Definitely want to talk about what other states have been talked about as far as the next state to the line to go the legalization route, especially if the federal government doesn't step in. And kind of your thoughts on where this all leads. So I want to invite our listeners to hang on through the break. And if you'd like to call, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. And you can talk about this issue, ask Daniel a question. Definitely open to that. And otherwise, we'll take a quick break here. And let me see. I had a song that I wanted to play, and of course, I can never find it in this darn board. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Daniel Williams right here on Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network.
Oh,
All right, we're back. Sorry, folks, got busy there in the break and apologize for the dip. We were discussing here with Daniel Williams the effects of the drug policy or the marijuana legalization laws that came out of Colorado and Washington, and we're going to bring him back on here. Daniel, are you back with us, sir?
Yes, I am, Ken. Thank you.
All right. Actually, you know what? I should go ahead and take care of business here real quick because it's the bottom of the hour. This is when I usually do it. So if you'd like to advertise on this, if you'd like to advertise on this or any of the other My View Matters radio network shows, you can do so by emailing myviewmatters, all one word, at AOL.com, myviewmatters@AOL.com. The rates are very reasonable and helps keep this show and the other shows on the network on the air. So reach out to them and get on board. So, all right, let's get back to the conversation here. The main thing I want to, I guess, start at here is, you know, we've seen these two states go. The initiative was in two other states and failed. What's the next states that are going to go? I mean, what's likely to queue up next to see, you know, who should we expect to see marijuana legalization out of next?
Well, there are a number of states that are looking at Colorado and what's happened in Washington. But it looks like Ohio has a pretty good momentum going there for legalization under the same type of situation that Colorado has. But you know, there's Nebraska that's looking at it. There are a number of states that are beginning to perk up on the issue. But it looks like Ohio could be the next state to follow Colorado and Washington.
No, in Ohio, I would assume that that's not going to be a legislative thing, that that's going to be done by referendum or initiative.
I would think that seems to be where the momentum is now. It'd be nice if they could do it as a amendment to the Constitution, but it's probably going to follow the same mold as Washington, more so than Colorado. It'd be an initiative or a proposition.
Okay. And I can't remember. I thought in Ohio there was a way to amend the Constitution through in fact, I know there is a way to amend the Constitution through petition. So that may not be out of the question as far as a constitutional amendment. I know that during the smoking ban fight, there were two different proposals that were out there, and one was a constitutional amendment and one was a law. And the two were conflicting with one another, and one passed and the other didn't. And they were both very confusing.
Right.
But I guess the point is that in Ohio, you could see a constitutional amendment there as well. You know, something we didn't touch on, and I often bring up, is actually what I think is the most brilliant part of all of this. If you simply just straight up decriminalize, before you put anything else in place about taxes or regulation or any of that stuff, you basically say, look, the state's not going to prosecute people for this anymore. It takes the onus off the states. It takes that burden, that financial burden that we talked about earlier, of the courts and law enforcement and everything involved in that incarceration, takes that off of the shoulders of the state government. It makes it so that the state government no longer has to enforce those laws. So even if the feds want to enforce those laws, well, that's great, but no state money is going toward it. And
well,
I don't know about your state, but here in Kentucky, we're pretty darn strapped for cash. And to me, it seems like just a smart thing to do to find anything to save some money and to start doing it because our main driver is our pension. But, you know, whatever the driver is, whether it's a pension or, you know, some other lofty failed plan, anything that can be done to save money, it seems like that's, if nothing else, the most brilliant part about it is it takes the burden off of the state to do any enforcement.
Well, I think that has merit, but probably the most important way, the most sound way to do it is through some type of legislative, either some type of legislative process. There's ramifications for the states just saying, well, we're not going to do it anymore. You'll have arguments within the states. You'll have your tough on crime, tough on drug DAs and prosecutors going after the state for not going after pot smokers. So it'd be a little too ambiguous for for it to be a widespread type of maneuver. But I mean, it's possible. But I think that's would be the least effective and least effective way to go, because it still leaves it in a limbo type of scenario.
And that's true. I just, you know, I'm looking at it from a pure financial perspective, and I also look at it through the prism of Kentucky, where I don't see Kentucky ever going legalization for any sort of liberty reason, you know, or any sort of common sense reason. It's going to come down to dollars and cents. And that's where I kind of see it as the brilliance of this is that I don't even know how much we spend in Kentucky on drug enforcement. I do know that we have a problem with pills and meth in the state, but I know that from a marijuana perspective, there has to be a sizable number, whatever that number is, of resources allocated towards enforcing our state laws against marijuana. And if those state laws were to go away, at that point it makes it so that those resources are now freed up to do whatever else they should be doing.
Right. Well, I'd like to move a little bit on this and take the long view on marijuana legalization. Let's make the assumption that marijuana is legal throughout the land. All 50 states have legalized marijuana. What happens then? And that's what most people really don't focus on. But I think it's important for your listeners to think about what happens if marijuana is legalized across the country. There's probably more downside potential than upside. And the reason I say that is when you talk to all the drug policy advocates out there that get most of the media time, Drug Policy Alliance, those groups, every one of those individuals, and I know them all, they all want to see prohibition ended across the board. They want prohibition to be repealed across the board, but they've taken the incremental approach. So when I talk to these guys, I say, okay, if marijuana is legalized across the country, what, since you think prohibition should be repealed, what drug will you champion next? Will you go for the legalization of cocaine? Will you go for the legalization of LSD? What's your next move in that game? And they all kind of look at me like, well, we don't know, or we haven't thought it through that far. The downside possibility is, when marijuana is legalized across the country, some of the promises won't come true. We have told people that if you legalize marijuana, it'll cripple the drug cartels. That's not going to happen. The drug cartels will lose X percentage of the revenue. It's been thought as to be as high as 70%, but I think it's somewhere around 20 to 25%. So the cartels are going to lose 25% of their profits. They're not going to sit still. They're not going to roll over. They're not going to say, okay, well, we lost that. And lick their wounds. What the drug cartels will do is they will step up the importation of meth, the importation of cocaine, the importation of heroin, and there's a strong possibility that because so much of the opium is grown in Mexico now and turned into heroin, that the drug cartels could introduce back into the country opium in its raw form, its smokable form. So to think that the drug cartels are going to be decimated or ruined by marijuana legalization just is not true. So when that doesn't happen, you're going to see the people you're going to see the prohibitionists go, see, we told you so. None of the crime has gone away. In fact, in some places it's got worse. So you're going to see a significant pushback against the legalization of marijuana, and we're going to be fighting for keeping pot legal at the expense of eliminating prohibition. The violent crime associated with prohibition is all in the narcotics trade. There's very little, I don't say very little, but the smallest amount of violence is in the marijuana trade. So you're still going to see a tremendous amount of violence. You're going to see drug abuse and the drug war continue unabated. And when those promises that we're making about marijuana legalization don't come true, we're going to be in a very difficult situation. We're not going to be able to move forward on bringing more sanity to the drug laws. We're going to be entrenched in a fight over marijuana until the cows come home. And you're going to see the general public be very wary of legalizing pot or going any further because the whole scheme of ruining the drug cartels does not come true. That to me is the biggest downside of the incremental approach, legalizing pot first. It may be the only thing that gets legalized, and then you're still going to see massive amounts of violence and death in Mexico and still in the United States. That's the downside.
Yeah, and I know, was it Portugal, I think it was, that did the full decrim? Is that right?
Yeah, 2001, correct.
Right, and everything I've seen anyway has suggested that it's worked out pretty well there.
The most recent reports have proven that it has worked out extremely well, even better than it's worked out in Amsterdam, because in Amsterdam it's still illegal to possess cocaine, heroin, LSD, things like that. In Portugal, they decriminalized the personal use of every drug, meth, coke, heroin, pot, everything. And that has led to a much better use statistics than what you have in Amsterdam. So there are fewer people going on to hard drugs. There are fewer people starting to use drugs to begin with. So Portugal has been a brilliant success by all metrics, all measurable metrics. Portugal has been an outstanding success. And the government in Portugal has come out and publicized this because they were just as surprised as everybody else. So now they're kind of patting themselves in the back, pumping on their chests and saying, look, we are the model for the rest of the world. So Portugal has done extremely well, and it was 2001, so it's been over 10 years. We've got a 10-year statistical record to look at, and all the results are absolutely great by comparison to where it was before. So Portugal has shown the world how to do it.
And I think that that's an important thing to bring up there that I am aware of, is that the other thing they did, not only did they decriminalize, but they also started focusing on the addiction rate or the addiction factor as a mental health thing, rather than, today, if someone's got a problem, there's a disincentive to come forward because of the criminality of the use. They actually are able to get people into treatment and get them turned around and get, get them the help that they need. And
that's
a big part.
For that small percentage of drug users that end up with a problem, and it is a very, very small percentage. It gets all the ink in the media, but it's a very small percentage of users that actually get into trouble. What Portugal has been able to do by redirecting resources away from law enforcement, they've directed some of those resources towards rehabilitation, medical treatment as opposed to jail treatment. And that's probably the most significant part of Portugal, but it's the least statistic that's referenced. But yes, they've been able to reallocate those resources towards a medical solution as opposed to a criminal justice solution.
Well, and I think that's an important thing, because I think that people make mistakes. They just in general, at the broad, right, in the broader scope of things, you make mistakes, you head down a road that turns out to be a disaster. I really believe that people need to have the opportunity to recognize it and to turn themselves around. And, when it comes to things like addiction, that's not an easy thing to do, especially on your own. And I think that that's a good thing, that the tools are in place for people to receive the help that they need to be rehabilitated. And for all intents and purposes, I mean, in theory, if they're rehabilitated, then they can reassimilate themselves into productive society and become, functional, normal people again. And I think that, in my opinion, is really should be the focus of all of this, really.
Well, you're absolutely right. When it comes to treating it from a medical standpoint as opposed to a criminal justice standpoint, the medical standpoint stays private. So if you have trouble with drugs, you get rehab, that becomes a private medical matter. It is not a part of your public record. It doesn't impact your ability to keep a job, get a job, move upwardly through the economic stratosphere. So that's very important. It doesn't become a part of your public persona as a medical issue. It becomes a part of your private deal. So it doesn't impact your ability to work, to go to school, things of that nature. That's very significant. Because as I mentioned at the top of the show, 800,000 people every year go into the criminal justice system, and they carry that stigma with them for a very long period of time because it's a public information situation. In the medical aspect, that's private and it doesn't get publicized, so you're shielded from the stigma.
Yeah, and I think the stigma certainly, and that plays into the ability to get a job. It plays into the ability. Sorry, it plays into the ability to what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, I mean, there's stigma there and the ability to get a job, and that is probably one of the worst things about it on our side of things where we're at right now, right? Which is that we have people that, you know, there was a good story on Reason, Reason Magazine's website about this a couple of months ago, about a guy who got an oxycodone pill from somebody at a club, wasn't even planning on using it, and the police busted him. And sent his life into a tailspin, lost his job and you know, everything else. And this is somebody who had a bright future ahead of them. And, you know, that's the funny thing is that's the real cost to all the drug war, that you can't even put a number on that. I mean, how do you figure out the lost opportunity of all these people who would have otherwise been productive members of society who now are outcast and forever have that stigma and can never,
right. I mean, we can,
you know, be shaken.
We can quantify the amount of hours that employees waste looking at porn or texting or, you know, looking at different websites. We can quantify that, but what we can't quantify is the lost productivity, the lost lives of those who are impacted with drug arrest. That is something that we've not been able to quantify. But I'm certain that it is extraordinarily high. I mean, I know way too many people to consider it just anecdotal. It is more empirical that when you get thrown into the criminal justice system, for whatever it is, but especially for non-violent simple possession, your life course is altered, and it is not altered in a positive way. So there's a tremendous amount of loss to the American economy from those who are held back from their greatest productivity, primarily due to a drug arrest.
Well, and we've heard a lot in the news lately, you know, as the campaign waned down at the end of October, beginning of November, and, you know, the lasting taglines, if you will, afterward, is the whole makers versus takers tagline. And so to abuse that line in some way, but really to make the point, what you're doing is, in a sense, turning a maker into a taker. Because, you know, you see the stories of people who, like the guy in Reason Magazine, you know, he had a good job, he had a bright future, now he can't get a job, now he's flipping burgers, he's making minimum wage, and, you know, now he's, I'm sure, qualifies for all the tax breaks and all that stuff for the lower income, and, you know, that, not to disparage anyone for any particular situation, but, you know, it seems like in that scenario, our policies are, if you will, to use the phrase, turning makers into takers. And for no real reason other than the person got busted using something or not even using something that, you know, will, at the end of the day, would not have otherwise made a significant impact on their life. I mean, as we started out earlier saying, Obama, Clinton, Bush all used these types of drugs in the past, and all three had become president of the U.S. So that's really, I guess. Go ahead.
Well, what you also have, Ken, is that a lot of these first-time offenders from nonviolent possession, when they're thrown into the criminal justice system and they see all the roadblocks that are placed up against them once they exit the criminal justice system, if exit's the right word, once they get through with their trials and the like, a lot of these people, when they look at their limited opportunities, turn to dealing drugs. So you get a guy who's not a drug dealer, he gets caught with an ounce of pot or something, goes to the criminal justice system, gets out, can't find a good job. A lot of them turn to drug dealing. So you're making drug dealers out of basically law-abiding citizens. So that's that's a terrible part of it. And a lot of the people that sell drugs are people who have been in the criminal justice system, and there's no other opportunity for them. So they go, fuck it. Oh, well, God, I'm sorry, Ken. They say to heck with it. They say to heck with it, and they start selling drugs. And it's just one vicious circle after another.
No, and I understand. And that's it's really unfortunate. And the main thing to take away from all of this, even if someone who's listening disagrees with what you or I have said about any of this, you know, the drug war has been going on now officially for over 40 years, and really many of these drugs have been illegal for much longer. What we're doing isn't working. I think that's really the key thing that we need people to realize is that our current policies are failing and at an enormous cost. I think, Daniel, help me, how much is spent in federal enforcement, $200 billion or $100 billion or something like that a year is spent on federal enforcement alone?
About the total combined of everything, federal, state, local, criminal justice system, lawyers, everything involved, is over $200 billion a year. So even in today's world, $200 billion is a lot of money. And that's how much we are wasting minimally every year in the war on drugs. And plus we are the DEA is throughout the world. The drug policy of the world is controlled by the United States. They can say the UN has all these agreements and conventions, but it is the United States that initiated drug prohibition, and it is the United States that is the one who can lead us out of this. So you've got countries like Portugal and things like that, but Portugal hasn't impacted the rest of the world. Portugal has impacted Portugal. If the United States was to have a common sense policy for drugs, you would see the world change very rapidly.
Yeah, and it would eliminate a lot of the negative things, as we've discussed, the cartels and all that stuff. You know, when you create a black market, there's a lot of profit and a lot of violence that goes along with any black market. And that's a lesson we should have learned back in the 20s. But it's there, and it's reality. And when you create a black market, if you make something illegal for which there is a market for, people will create a black market for it. And the harder, the more strict of the regulations you put on to try to stop that black market, the more profitable that black market becomes, and thus you really start creating these super empires of the cartels. And that's we need to have a new approach. I think looking at Portugal is definitely a very good thing to do, and say, you know, what is it that they're doing that we're not? And basically they're doing the inverse of what we're doing. I think that's something that we really need to examine as a country and as individuals, to try to figure out, you know, where is it that we stand on these issues? What is the best answer? If you really think that what we're doing today is the best answer, then be ready to open your pocketbook, because it costs more and more money every year, and you're making more and more people, putting more and more people into the criminal justice system every year, and making it so that those people will never be able to obtain gainful employment beyond flipping burgers or doing, you know, menial minimum wage work for the rest of their lives. And
well, if we want to eliminate the drug cartels and all the attendant violence and problems with that, the only way to do that is to repeal drug prohibition and create a legal and regulated market to sell these drugs. And anybody who believes that, you know, Big Pharma is a big target. People hate Big Pharma. But nobody should believe that Big Pharma is not interested in legalizing drugs. Those are the companies that made all the money to begin with, selling heroin and opium and cocaine and things like that. The pharmaceutical companies, or the precursors to the pharmaceutical companies, are the ones that were making all the money. If you could get any of the pharmaceutical companies aside and have them speak candidly, they would all welcome the repeal of drug prohibition, because their market would expand dramatically. So don't any of your listeners out there think that the pharmaceutical companies aren't watching this and are hoping that drug prohibition is repealed, because their profits on drugs will dramatically increase. They were doing very well before Prohibition. They were the main companies that were supplying the world, and they'll be the companies that will supply a regulated drug marketplace in the world. They want this to happen.
Well, that's very interesting. So, but all right, we've got about 3 minutes left, Daniel. What do you have going on? You got anything to plug?
Well, I'll tell you what, if anybody is still with us, I'd be more than glad to send them a free copy of my book. All they got to do is contact you at My View Matters, give them their name and address. You can communicate that to me, and I'll send them out a free copy of my book, The Naked Truth About Drugs.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And for listeners, I would highly recommend you take advantage of that. We have, I guess the best way to do that would be on the Facebook page under tonight's show. If you want to just reply, say, I want a book, Daniel, I'll make sure that we put those folks in contact with you, and we'll get you guys a free book from Daniel.
I want to put a quick caveat on that, because you've got tens of thousands of listeners. I don't have that many books. Let's limit this to like 50 or 100 or something.
Okay.
Because if all of a sudden, 6,000 people want a free book, I'm screwed. So let's put a first come, first serve, maybe 50 or 100, and we'll let it go at that. How's that?
That sounds quite reasonable. So,
okay.
Well, Daniel, thank you very much. And for those that don't know, Daniel did write a book called The Naked Truth About Drugs. And it's a good read, and I would recommend it to folks. And with that, we've got about a minute and a half left. Daniel, thank you very, very much for coming on the show today. Certainly appreciate your input, both as a guest and as a listener. And we'll talk again soon. I'm going to put you back on the hold here till the end of the show. Thanks, Daniel.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
And, folks, with a minute remaining, I just want to emphasize to folks, there was the shooting this past week, and a lot of people are jumping on this bandwagon and trying to call for a political solution. We don't have all the facts yet. We don't have all the information yet. I want to encourage people to sit back, wait until we get all the facts. I have a strong suspicion, although I'm not going to say for sure, that this is going to come out to another mental health issue. And it brings up a broader point of our use of mental health facilities in this country, both in the drugs aspect and in general with things like this. We need to really help those that literally cannot help themselves when they have a mental disorder. But I don't want to hear people calling for political solutions yet, not until we have all the facts, not until we know what the heck happened. And then we can start talking about answers. The knee-jerk reactions are never the right reactions. Folks, that's another show in the books. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in next week for another edition of Liberty Unbridled. Have a good week.